Today, on Rainbow Country, serial killer Bruce MacArthur, sentencing news conference from Toronto Police Headquarters, plus the Gay Artist's Way featuring recording artist Santino. Stay tuned for Gay Talk Radio Toronto Style right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls, and you're listening to Rainbow Country on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Here on Rainbow Country, we may use language not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. No matter who you are.
Hi, I'm Mayor John Tory.
No matter what you do.
This is City Councilor Kristen Wong Tam.
We all have a story to tell. And it starts right here on this gay radio show, helping to give voice to the LGBT community. Together, we'll lift our voices, share our stories, and we'll raise our pride. I'm Mark Tara. Join me on this ever-expanding journey through Rainbow Country. Welcome to Rainbow Country, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community. As always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm Mark Tara. Get social, get interactive on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at Mark Tara Music. The podcast for Rainbow Country is on iTunes, Podomatic.com, Google Play Music, Stitcher Radio, and on Spotify. So, if you listen to podcasts on a regular basis, don't forget, subscribe to Rainbow Country, because that way you'll keep up to date with all things Rainbow Country, especially when the new episodes are released online. And of course, everything is hooked up at my website, including the full 2-hour archives. MarkTara.com. M-A-R-K T-A-R-A.com. So, local artist Mikey Sin, who creates fashions, costumes, that sort of thing, has a new exhibit going on until March 30th. So you've got some time to go check it out. It's at 11 Salon. It's in, believe it or not, in a hairstylist, salon at 11 Irwin Avenue. Just north of Wellesley off of Yonge Street. So right downtown in the downtown core, Yonge and Wellesley, just north. 11 Irwin Avenue. It's really worth seeing. So I hope you'll take some time between now and March 30th to check out Mikey Sin, his new exhibit at 11 Salon, right in the downtown core. So my friends, this is episode 138. On this episode, serial killer Bruce MacArthur, sentencing news conference from Toronto Police Headquarters. So we're going to hear from Police Chief Mark Saunders, Homicide Inspector Hank Exinga, Detective David Dickinson, and the LGBTQ2S Liaison Officer, Constable Danielle Botno. Plus, in Hour 2 of Rainbow Country, the Gay Artist Way, featuring recording and hair and makeup artist Santino. So my friends, this journey through Rainbow Country begins right now with serial killer Bruce MacArthur sentencing news conference from Toronto Police Headquarters.
Hi, I'm Mayor John Tory, and you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM.
First off, our thoughts and prayers go out to the families and friends of those men that we have lost. The impact of loss of life in the city is something that has a tremendous impact on all of us, and so we always look forward to move forward and try to figure out what we need to do to best help in every way. Listening to the agreement, the agreed statements of fact was a painful but a necessary process, and we're grateful for those who chose to participate in this final phase of the case. The victim impact statements were meaningful and gave the public keen insight into the impact of this case that it had on the City of Toronto. We're extremely grateful to Crown Attorney Michael Cantillon and his team, who did a fantastic job working with us and bringing us to where we are today. By no stretch of the imagination was this an easy task. It was incredibly difficult for all of us. Since the beginning, our investigators were motivated to bring justice to the victims, their families, and the community as a whole. And I would like to thank them for their efforts. But our work is not done. We will continue to support the opportunity to explore our investigative efforts in a transparent and accountable way. And we'll continue to cooperate with Justice Epstein's review and the efforts that are made there. We'll also continue to partner with the LGBTQ plus community to rebuild the trust that is essential to reporting crime and to solve crime. Like no other case, this has reinforced our responsibility as a police service to continually evolve and to get better at what we do through improved policies, procedures, training, or any other thing. We will do everything that we can to continue to strengthen our relationships with communities and figure out what we need to do to learn and grow as a police agency working with our communities. And with me today, I have Inspector Hank Edzinga, as well as Detective Dave Dickinson, who were the leaders of this investigation. I also have Constable Daniel Botineau, who is, I will say, one of the strongest when it comes to policing and liaisoning with the LGBT community. She has an international footprint and has by far been one of my strongest assets when it comes to this discussion. I will open up the forum and platform to you to ask questions to any one of us. If you could just please come up so that if you get asked a question, you can answer. Go ahead.
Could you start by sharing with us if you think the sentence, while symbolic in some ways, is satisfactory?
Well, there are two things that I have to look at. First, if it was one of my loved ones, there wouldn't be any sentence that would make me happy. But when I look at Justice McMahon, who I know is one of the most knowledgeable individuals that I know when it comes to law in Canada, you couldn't have put it through a better individual to have the outcome. And let's be honest here, I do not see Bruce MacArthur seeing daylight. I do not see him in a public setting ever again. If he were to be paroled, then we'd have to start questioning our sentencing in the country. I'll take it for face value that in this case that life will mean life at the end of the day. He's eligible for parole in 25 years. That doesn't mean he's going to be free.
Chief, we also see the fact that probably the investigators are probably used to interview Bruce MacArthur in 2013. We don't know much of the details, then can you share some of those? And can you reflect on what it means that you had a serial killer in the police station and you let him go?
Well, as understanding investigations and knowing how complex they are and the large bandwidth in which we took well before with Project Houston and the resources and time and effort and the officers and the judicial authorizations that were put forward, it wasn't until late January of last year when we had that tangible connection. Inspector Edzinga can talk in more detail with respect to that. And I certainly do not want this to be an opportunity to go through every aspect of the investigation. We are definitely going to be transparent. I feel very strong about the hard work that was done by the Toronto Police Service and all agencies that assisted us. But I do believe that the public has some questions. A lot of people are satisfied with the investigation when they sit down and listen to what happened and how it broke down with the exposure of the ITOs that took place. They understood the comprehensive investigation that took place. We did not sit flat with this at any moment. So some people are very satisfied with what has happened. Some need answers to questions, as you are asking right now, and others are not satisfied. As an organization, the ability to learn, not because we have to, because we want to, is what's most important. And the right forum for the discussion to go right down to minutia on every individual item that led up to this conclusion, I certainly am willing and looking forward to those opportunities.
Chief, you sort of partially answered it, but in December we were here and you indicated there was no evidence of a serial killer. And then you sort of partially answered it because it wasn't until January.
That's correct.
Although Bruce McCarver was on the radar, was that an investigative decision when you said that, or did you not know at that time there was evidence of a serial killer?
Well, Joe, one of the luxuries I don't have is hindsight, and we as law enforcement have to deal with the evidence that we have at that time. When we're talking about a crime, that we're talking homicide here, and we're talking multiple homicide here, and it was something that we looked at, so we were looking at it for years. At that moment, when I made that statement, I was very, very specific with what I said because it was accurate and right. When I said, at this time, there is no evidence to say that we had a serial killer. And you have to look at all lanes with this. You have to look at who committed the murders. You have to look at whether it was one person who did it, whether or not there are copycats that did it, or whether or not there are a multitude of people. So to say that there was, with no evidence to suggest that at that time, would have been completely inaccurate on my part. I can tell you the moment that we knew what we had, the moment we had evidence to tell us that, we acted immediately. And that's why we have this conclusion right now. It was clearly indicated that because of the investigation that Inspector Dzinga and Detective Dickinson, putting all those resources together and framing the case properly, it was an outstanding job done by them. So the work was done by law, using evidence, for a court forum, not the forum of public opinion, Joe, and you understand that better than most in the room, for courts. At the end of the day, we are responsible to bring investigations based on evidence, not emotion, to a courtroom to be tried, to be tested, to withstand the scrutiny in order to have what we have today.
But you
feel your word may have put the public at risk? Don't you feel that deaths could have been prevented had you warned the public sooner? Didn't you have strong enough suspicions?
No. What I said is what I stand by, and I'll keep that. If you want to keep mixing it up, you can go ahead. We had put our investigators at the forefront, and not only investigators, I put specialized people when we started Project Houston to work with the community, to interview as many people as possible. This was not taken lightly, and it's still not taken lightly, and that's part of the reason why I'm looking forward to that opportunity to properly have that forum where those discussions can be had so that there is a clear understanding of law, a clear understanding of everything that we had, and the true test is what did you do with the information at the time. And I can tell you from what I know and from what I've experienced in this case, things were done properly, and the messagings that were put out there were accurate in the time. We do have the luxury, we have the luxury of hindsight right now, and that's unfortunate. And the amount of homicide cases that I've done, I can tell you if I had redo moments, almost every single case, I would have a redo moment. And that's part of the learning process. And I think what makes this particular case unique was that it was a serial killer. And, you know, it's a dark day in Canada, but a darker day in the city of Toronto when we had to investigate and apprehend a serial killer. And so there are some uniquenesses to it. And so we will do everything we can to make people more aware of law and of how we present cases before the court and what our responsibilities and accountabilities are. And I don't have the luxury of making assumptions, especially large assumptions like that, to the public. I have to be able to be solid with what I say in the office of the chief in order to have that integrity for the investigation and as well as for the court proceedings.
Chief, question for you and maybe a question for your team.
But was there any sort of deal made with Mr. MacArthur before his guilty plea was entered in the court? Were there any kinds of conditions placed on it? Were there any agreements made? Can you give us a little bit more information about the circumstances that led to this?
No, I will just comment to say that Bruce MacArthur pled guilty to 8 counts of first-degree murder. It's the most serious offense in the criminal code. So no, he pled guilty. That was his choice.
Did you ask for concessions about where he would be incarcerated?
No.
Is he going to stay in Ontario? Where would he be?
I don't know. At the end of the day, he goes into Corrections Canada, and it's up to them to place him for safety of himself, but also safety of the general public.
If there had been a trial, we would have heard from you as a witness. Can you just tell us, the day that you guys entered that apartment, can you give us some look at what his reaction was when police arrived at his door?
I don't think this is the forum to talk about that. I will discuss that at some point down the road, but I don't think this is it. We made a decision based on the evidence we had at that time. Yes, it was the right decision, but, you know, I want you to understand that throughout the entire investigation, we had steps in place to mitigate any risk to the public. Even when Bruce MacArthur was first on our radar, just as a name, we put people and resources in place to mitigate any risk. And at any point when he was elevated to a person of interest, to a suspect, the people and the resources changed to mitigate any risk to the public. And at the end of the day, the people did what they had to do on January 18th, and we arrested him.
The life of the man known as John, and that because of the work that you and your team brought Bruce MacArthur to justice. So he gave you quite a compliment. Just your reaction to that, and also, no one has spoken to John. You know that John is not his real name. Can you tell us a bit about this?
No, I don't want to talk about John for his privacy. Throughout this investigation, there are obviously the people that want to be in the spotlight. They want to tell their side of the story, but behind the scenes, there are dozens who don't want to, and John is one of them, and I'm not going to discuss any further about John. What His Honor said, of course, about myself and my team, very appreciative of, but I've said this before, I don't want to make this about us. We acted, we did what we were trained to do, and it worked out. But yes, no, I appreciate his comments, but you have to also understand that there were dozens, hundreds of officers working behind the scenes that assisted that day.
But we learned from the statement of facts that his criminal record was still, not as much as the interviews from the team. We know people from the community, friends of the victims, were saying, Bruce MacArthur was seen with my friend before they were missing. Is it a matter that the evidence wasn't there, or did you not treat these cases as though they were suspicious, or what else needed to happen?
Justin, the evidence was there on January 17th of 2017, or sorry, 2018. That was the date the evidence was there, and we acted and arrested him the very next day.
You were one of the few officers, sat in a room with him and interviewed him. Did he ever say to you, did he ever give you any indication of why he did what he did?
The conversations that I've had with Bruce MacArthur, I want to keep private right now. I will continue to strive to bring answers and closure to some of the questions that people have, but right now I want to keep any conversations that I've had with Bruce MacArthur private.
The detective mentioned that while MacArthur took responsibility for his crime, but he does not think he's remorseful. Do you share those sentiments?
Again, something I don't want to comment on right now. I will agree. I don't think he's remorseful, but I'm not saying that going forward, they're not. There may be some assistance that can help. Not something I'm going to comment right now.
And did you ever consider main charges in the case of the men that you found the day MacArthur was arrested? Because we were informed that he was being held against his will, and that the judges clearly expected he would have been arrested. So did you consider main charges in that case at all?
No, we did not, and I'm not going to get into that any further.
This question is for both the detective and the cleanup. After all the work that you've put into this and the things that you've seen and experienced, this sentence can't be satisfactory. I understand that Mr. MacArthur is going to be 91 when the 25 years are up and he'll probably never see the light of day again, but the sentence can't be satisfactory. He's one of the worst serial killers in this country.
It's still a life sentence, The only difference is the parole eligibility, and as Justice McMahon said, he can't imagine a parole board ever letting Mr. MacArthur out, even if by some fluke he lives to the age of 91. We don't expect to see Mr. MacArthur in public again. We're satisfied with the sentence.
You are satisfied with all the work you and everyone
have
put into it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't think I've ever given a specific number on it. There are quite a few cold cases. We are still not quite done reviewing those, but we're getting close to the end. And as I've said before, so far we have absolutely no evidence to link Mr. MacArthur to any of those cases.
In the statement of facts, that police only found some of the victims based on the photos that you discovered on his hard drives. So in those cases, you found the victim, he was charged, he's been punished for those crimes. Can you say with any degree of certainty you believe there are no other victims at no other point in his life?
At this point in time, like I said, we're still looking at cold cases. As far as we know, based on the evidence that we have, the first individual that he killed was Scanlon Avaratnam in 2010.
Can you please speak to what it was like for you and the number of previous investigations as well? What it was like for you to be informed
on this? Well, for myself and my team, I can say it was closure for us. This isn't the first and only murder case that I've had before the courts, and the courts, it's a long process, and to have this concluded, this is a quick conclusion. You know, we were in the courts for years sometimes with a basic murder case, so to have one where someone's charged with 8 murders conclude within 13 months of the arrest, it's fulfilling. It's nice that it is done. This investigation is far from done, so it's not done in that aspect, but it is nice to have the court process done. Like I've mentioned before, we will continue to look at any connection that Bruce MacArthur has to anybody, missing persons, other, we've looked at cold cases. We will continue to look to see if there are any other links that we have not seen to date. But again, there is no evidence to date to suggest there's any more murders that he's responsible for. And you said it was as a team. It was me who did the search, but yes, it was an entire team effort, and many of them are here today. So, a big piece of that evidence was a note left by Andrew Kinsman himself. In hindsight, he left the name of his killer on his calendar. And, the investigation doesn't flow as fluidly as what's described in the agreed statement of facts. But, eventually, we tied Bruce to Bruce MacArthur. And a lot of that was thanks to Andrew Kinsman and his calendar.
Does all the information in this statement of facts come from you and your investigators, or did any of the information come from Bruce MacArthur?
I can't comment on that right now. I believe the agreed statement of facts was the investigation itself.
So he didn't give you any information that has been made public in that sense?
I've commented before. I said earlier, I'm not going to comment right now on the conversations that I've had with Bruce MacArthur.
What was the chance of disciplinary charges against Sergeant Gauthier if he was so negligent in his investigation that we found back in 2016, and if that's the opinion of upper management, if there's somebody who's negligent in this investigation, why did it take so long to bring disciplinary charges against him when his interview with MacArthur took place back in 2016?
Yeah, there are a couple of things to that. First and foremost, there is nothing that I've said that has put anyone in guilt for anything that is done. Understanding a tribunal, and I think a lot of people are a bit confused with that. First off, it's not a trial. It's an employee-employer situation. And as law enforcement, we have tribunals. But when it comes to investigations, we ask, what did you do with the information you had at the time? Now, it seems pretty simple, but that is the fundamental process of what the tribunal is. What did you do with the information that you had at the time? And then the second piece is, if you're in certain specialized moments or units, there are accreditations. And in some instances, the accreditations are, most of them are provincial, but when it comes to audits and accountabilities for procedures, would say you need to do certain things. Some of them are provincially audited, and some are also audited by us. So those are all of the factors that are involved, and because we have to withstand the scrutiny of courtroom decorum, things are audited. So what you did would be in your memo books. What you did would be on your any reports you submitted would be timestamped with what information you put in there. So it's an opportunity for the officer to explain what he or she did. That's the purpose of a tribunal. So I've never, ever said that there is an assumption of guilt. It provides the opportunity for the transparency in a forum where you'll be scrutinized to certain questions to say, what did you do and what were your responsibilities? That's it.
You mentioned in your earlier remarks about hindsight for yourself, and now I think you've softened it up for Sergeant Boche to explain that was a procedural thing that he was facing. This is an out-of-the-box situation where everything is magnified in the types of head. And I think that from his letter, he feels that these extra two murders that happened post his interview, he's been blamed for it. I think that although he has to have this procedural tribunal, he could help perhaps him and the whole country understand what the position, your position at least, on him. Is he responsible for that, or is this a procedural thing that should have worked out more time?
Well, I certainly did not magnify it, Joe. I mean, I'm responding to a newspaper article based on a letter written, whether it was or was not. So the question was asked. When it comes to tribunal issues, I try to stay arm's length because that's important. And you know, me having a strong arm in it is very hard because I spoke about the audit mechanism. And we have case laws based on all of this. So it's simply a matter of, what did you do? When did you do it? Where did you write it? Where did you record it? And the accountability piece. So bring it. Absolutely. Every officer will get a fair hearing. It's under the Police Services Act, Joe. And if there are issues with the tribunals, there are opportunities and forums to articulate those particular points.
Chief, did he help us one more thing on that? Did his information help with this conclusion?
Well, Joe, you get right back to the first point where I'm saying I'm trying to create an environment so that he has a fair process in the tribunal, and he will have the opportunity, subjective or objectively, to bring those points out in that proper form. I don't think at a new scrum that is the place for it, and he'll have those avenues.
Chief,
we're
Chief.
More about those interviews, thanks to the tribunal, but to this point, there's no review of the two police investigations that located this person. Of course, the first case is not the homicide. Is there a benefit to a public inquiry? And if it does go forward, what do you think could be learned? And what role could the Toronto Police play in maybe, you know, getting an inquiry?
Yeah, well, you know what, I'm working with the board on this. The board has been watching and has been asking questions. They too want to understand the transparency and the obligation to make sure that as an organization we're doing everything to maintain fairness and accountability for everything that we do. And so I'll be working with the board. I know that they have proactively taken steps on this. It's not because this has happened now they're doing things. They've taken proactive steps to ensure that that accountability piece is there. And whatever form it will take place in, I will be glad to bring in our team, our investigators, our evidence, what we knew, when we knew, what we did, and why we did what we did. So I'm very cognizant, and if we're going to get this right, because it, you know, first off, there's loss of life, and I don't want to diminish that. I think that is crucially important. As an organization, we want to do everything we can to reduce those opportunities or moments to ever happen. But secondly, we have to build relationships. We don't solve crimes without relationships with communities, all communities right across the city. And the LGBTQ plus community plays a very strong role in the relationship piece, with crime solving, with all of those things. And so that is a continuous work that will go and continue regardless of whatever format we have that public ability or platform to articulate what we did. So collectively, we all want to get it right. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. If we can learn from this, then we will capitalize on that because I think it's important. But I also want to keep things in context. It is very rare that we have serial killers. It is very rare. And there are a lot of newness for us as police, a lot of newness for you as media, because you're all here today. Normally, when I've got good news stories, I see one or two, but I got a room full plus right now that are here. And it's not to be salacious, because you genuinely want to know what's going on and what can be done in the future. So I'm grateful for that. But let's take it in context. This is not a normal day-to-day situation. The pressures that were involved for the investigation and a massive team that brought us here is a tremendous result of hard work and dedication working with the community. But there are things that we can do to improve upon, and I'm looking forward to those moments. Wendy, you haven't asked the question.
I just want some clarity on whether you support both the public inquiry and the ongoing FC review. There are certain limitations to the missing persons review that the public inquiry could actually solve. So can you say right now, do you support a public inquiry?
I'm sure you all are going to figure out what storyline you're going to prove to move towards of what you want to have happen. But I can tell you, I'm working, Joe, I thought I gave you one, right? But I'll reiterate it again. We will be working with the board to figure out what the best solutions are, and we are proactive about it. We are not hesitating. I've said over and over again, we want to be transparent. We want to get this right, Wendy. And I've not diminished my language is very strong on that, and it still is.
Do you continue to be asked by members of the public why Risen Carver's mugshot was never released? I know there's been a bit of clarity on it, but perhaps not enough for members of the public because they continue to ask.
Sure.
And at your year end, you said you look into it. So what is the answer for members of the public who are thinking image of this man, you know, outside Niagara Falls.
Yeah, I'll have an expert answer the question.
And will you release it now? Perhaps there's no reverse.
We have no plan. we have no plans to release it. I explained last year why we weren't releasing it. We would normally release it if it had any, it created any investigative gain for us, and it absolutely does not. We discussed it with the Crown attorneys as far as including it in the agreed statement of facts, and it was decided not to. So we have no plans to release it at this point in time.
Today we heard in court that the judge was leaning. Was there were many benefits to a consecutive sentence that he in the end went with it in the current. What do you think about his reasons for not having a consecutive sentence?
Well, as the chief said, that's you're listening to one of the best judges in the country, and I think he addressed every area of his concerns and made the right decision at the end of it. So he was very articulate with how he expressed his decision, and like I said, we have no regrets about his decision.
Okay. Well, the jury still hangs over the heads of these families that should he live to be 91, they are facing that prospect of parole.
The odds of that ever happening are between slim and nil, I'd suggest. So I don't think any of the families are too concerned about facing a parole hearing in 25 years.
Was the investigation, to your knowledge, the most followed through on that?
Absolutely, and the chief addressed it already as well. When the search warrants for Project Houston were released, a lot of the criticisms and the questions that I had heard in early 2018 about the police not doing anything in 2010, 2012, 2013 were completely silenced when they saw the volume of work that went into those missing persons occurrences. And let's not forget that the surveillance video that Detective Dickinson relied on was obtained by officers from 51 Division responding to a missing persons report and having the wherewithal to canvas for that video and obtain that video just in case some foul play came into play.
Very soon after the other
men's disappeared. Most of them were between 10 days to 15 days before they were reported missing. Basir Fazi, I believe, was the only one who was reported within 48 hours. To Peel Police, and Peel Police conducted that investigation in 2010, 2011. But like I said, a lot of the criticisms that I heard are from people who don't realize what really is going on behind the scenes. And I believe Detective Radford is here in the back, and 51 Division, the officers and the investigators from there responding to Kinsman. Like I said, it was reported within 48 hours, his disappearance, and thankfully that video was still there and hadn't been overwritten. If he had been reported 10, 15 days later, we probably wouldn't be here today because that video would have been gone.
Thank you.
Inspector, your comments and Sergeant Gauthier's comments, he says he's being made the fall guy, he's being used as a scapegoat for some of the errors made in this investigation.
Right.
So what are your comments on that?
I'm not going to comment on it. If that's his position, I haven't seen this letter that everyone's talking about. It wasn't sent to me, and it's before the tribunal right now. And I've explained, and I've explained in the past what my role was in that leading to a tribunal. So we'll leave it for the tribunal.
Do you think, by just moving forward, what are the next steps? And this may be a question for either of you. Are there going to be further conversations with Mr. MacArthur? If so, what is the nature of those conversations, and what will the intent be? From that perspective of just dealing with him as an individual, what is the plan?
And I think Detective Dickinson has already answered that question.
Can we get a couple of calls along?
Yeah.
I'm just curious because, you know, throughout this whole investigation, throughout the murder trial, there's been frustration, there's been fear in the community, and the reaction of the court judge's other comments that, you know, the community didn't do enough to bring it forward, again, sparked a lot of frustration and anger in the community. You're the liaison. I mean, what have you done to allay those concerns or to build those bridges that you talked about?
I think it's important to note that I haven't been the only one doing the work that's out there to build those bridges back. The conversations have continued. We've acknowledged what the community is going through, and they are hurting and they are grieving. And hopefully this is the first stepping stone to move forward, not only by themselves, but with us. Our priority has been the community going through this entire process, and we're going to continue to have them as the priority. But it's going to take time, right? And we're just going to continue to have those conversations and build bridges.
Has there been anything concrete? You know, there's still the back and forth over pride and the involved officers. You can point to anything concrete to say, you know, this is the step we've taken to build those bridges?
Yeah, we've been doing community consultations with organizations that invited us into their space. Myself and Deputy McLean has been going in there, and it's not about us talking, it's about actually listening to the voices and their needs and their concerns. And we haven't, you know, highly published that, but the work has been done. We also have the neighborhood officers in 51 that has been put into the village, and they're doing some great work down there and having conversations with the community. So there's a few concrete things that have taken place, but there's still a lot more to do.
The day of the arrest, I think that would be for Detective Dickinson. How long was the time that passed between when Bruce MacArthur and this man John went inside that building and when your officer put in?
I'd say approximately 10 or 15 minutes. Enough time for us to put everything in place to do that.
Was there any records in any of the other missing men's cell phones, computers, apps that should have pointed to the current issue? I think specifically it's the message, you know, I believe in contact with Mr. MacArthur, but of course you did not need it to the serial killer.
I don't know if I can answer that right now, Justin. I mean, there was evidence that we have uncovered to link some men to Bruce MacArthur, not just Salim Essen and Andrew Kinsman. You have some evidence, but it's not enough to arrest. We did not have the evidence to arrest Bruce MacArthur until January 18th.
Of course, you have evidence to arrest him. You had evidence to surveil him for months and months and months in advance of that.
Correct.
But, you know, I guess walking through a little bit more of why wasn't there the evidence there to even take the next step and move MacArthur from that column of, you know, material witness to potential suspect?
Well, I did. I got involved in this investigation on August 14th, and from that time on, when we built Bruce MacArthur, I'm not going to say Mr. MacArthur, we built Bruce MacArthur and obtained that evidence throughout to ultimately move him from just the name to a person of interest, to a suspect, and ultimately to accused, now a convicted murderer.
If that was the case, then I have to go back to the very first question that was put to the chief. If Bruce MacArthur was under surveillance for several months, became a person of interest, and it escalated, why on December 18th, I think it was, did the chief make that remark, that comment about there not being a serial killer?
As the primary investigator, I support the chief and support what he said was accurate at that time.
So you didn't have the digital evidence back?
We did not have the evidence at that time to arrest Bruce MacArthur for anything at that time.
You had your suspicions.
Chief, did you
I just want to answer Rosie. Yeah, Rosie, and that is a good question because there is confusion. At that point in time, it was not for a multitude of homicides. It was for one. We had evidence for a homicide, Mr. Kinsman, at the time, and that was the status change because we had some tangible stuff only on that, not on everything else. As the investigation continued to evolve and accelerate at an incredibly fast pace in a short period of time, it exploded into the multiple victims. So when I made that comment, we had a person that we're interested in, wasn't even suspect at that point in time, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong on that, but it was either a person of interest or suspect for a homicide, not for the serial component.
So you made a decision for your predecessor, but was it a mistake to end Carter Creason when you did? If you had left, it was still an investigation, was it pretty serious? No. Was it a mistake to end it after, over a year?
I do understand your frustration, and again, having that luxury of hindsight, I can't tell you how it's great to have. In real time, I can tell you when we put investigations in play, especially large-scale investigations, which we did long before, you follow the evidence to the best of your extent, and then you try to extract evidence to the best of your extent, and you keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and then when you reach those wall moments where whether it's coming in or not coming in or whether there's absolutely nothing else to extract, you kind of have to take a step back. And that's exactly what the case was, which is when you look at how we led into the second piece of the investigation. So we had a team of officers, investigators, highly trained from 51 Division, working with homicide for the Houston investigation. So they have consumed a tremendous amount of knowledge for that investigation of what was going on in the village at that time. And I also want to delineate, this was not a case of the police didn't think anything was going on. We knew something stunk. There was no ifs, ands, and buts, which is why we put millions of dollars into it. We knew something stunk, and we did everything we could to find it, and we just didn't. But when it reactivated, when we had that fresh nerve into play, we were able to pull out members that were specialized, Detective Dickinson, that had the historical knowledge, plug him in with other resources to continue. So it wasn't this ad hoc thing. It was very methodical. The mindset was there. We had huge concerns. We resourced to the best of our ability at the time. And I have to be fair, and we have to strike that balance for when we stop investigations. We don't just go, boom, this is it, and we stop whether we have anything or not. If we have it, we go and we continue. And that is exactly what we did. And if you follow the ITOs that were released, and if you follow the agreed statement of facts, you can kind of put the framework together really well if you choose to, or if you don't, and that's fine. It's your call. But there's still more that the public needs to know and needs to understand. And I'm here to say that's not a concern to us. We want to do that. We want to take that over a step to figure out what platform that will happen in, working with the board so that we can get to the minutiae, which is the stuff that you and also the community wants to know. And we want to do it in a proper format in the best way possible.
Now that you have a dedicated person, does that change how those sort of investigations work? Previously it was a special project, and it was the homicide investigators or from the division looking at these cases. Now that there's a dedicated team, is that going to change the formula for how you deal with this?
I think that it will. I really do think that it will enhance accountability things, less things will slip through, and we will, we're always continuing to figure out what we need to get better at what we do. And so once a gap is identified, and the missing persons unit is just an exact example of that, okay, what were the gaps and what's the best methodology to move forward, and then we learn from it, we go back, we evaluate, and if there's more that we need to enhance, then we will. So it's always evergreen, and we are listening and we're working with to figure out what the best practice needs to be for Toronto. It's not a one-size-fits-all.
I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Andrew Kinsman and his role in this, with writing Bruce down, also the whole everything we knew MacArthur for a period of time. But I'd like to know if there's been any consideration past or going forward, that perhaps because it did not fit a profile, that he had smelled something rotten as well in this, and perhaps that was part of what happened then. Did he think that perhaps he was a victim because he thought something was up?
Sorry, I don't quite understand your question.
Okay. He knew MacArthur for a long time, so by murdering Andrew Kinsman, this case sort of turned a different direction for him.
It wasn't the usual profile. People were given no one. Everyone did it. So the question is that there are some people that have said that Andrew Kinsman is suspicious of something. Is there any evidence to show that perhaps he was victimized? You know, I'm not saying he wasn't involved in a relationship, but that he said something. Obviously, from your lack of understanding of the question, you must be lying, but I just won't get up.
Well, I think the Crown said it in their agreed statement of facts that Mr. MacArthur made a mistake when he killed Andrew Kinsman. Andrew Kinsman was not quite in the same profile as a lot of the other victims, and it definitely left a trail, and it was a mistake on Mr. MacArthur's part.
So why did he kill Andrew Kinsman? Anything beyond what we know?
That's... No.
I have a question about the agreed statement of facts. There's a gap in them, without getting too graphic, but there's a gap, there's information missing in the agreed statement of facts, and I'm just curious what we're supposed to infer from that, if Bruce MacArthur didn't agree to something. It doesn't really lay out the dismembering. And we're not sure if there was a separate site for that or if it happened in his apartment or anything like that. There was only a mention, and it was just quickly mentioned about a saw in his van that was found.
The agreed statement of facts, much like a lot of issues in this case, is based on evidence. And we don't have the evidence to say where he committed the dismemberments, whether the dismemberments were committed in the same place or in multiple places. So that's why that's not in there.
So does that mean he didn't share that information with you if you asked him?
Again, we're not going to talk too much about the conversations we've had with Mr. MacArthur or any future conversations.
The statement of facts is quite likely.
You're not talking about the conversation that you're planning to have with Mr. MacArthur, but can you speak to the fact that part of that conversation led you to help the families kind of close this? Awful time to realize, because many of them haven't been up until now, so they still don't understand why they found members, and they contact them, so I know you can get into the details, but is part of that motivation speaking to get to fill in the blanks, not just in the previous statement of facts, but also for the families
of each family? Well, again, I'm not going to answer the question about whether there will be future conversations or not, but the volume of the disclosure and the evidence gain from Project Houston, Project PRISM, that the Crown relied upon is what they put into that agreed statement of facts. So if there's something relevant in there that they could establish strongly enough to introduce into a court of law, it would be in there. And if it's not in there, that's why it's not in there.
Last question, please.
The search of his apartment was very extensive. That's been covered. So in looking at the search so in your team's professional opinion, did it look like the dismemberments happened there? Because it's very difficult to get a body out. I'm sure for him to lift Andrew Kinsman, any of the bodies, it would have been extremely difficult. So we're just trying to get a sense, did it look like that happened in his apartment?
You're right. It would have been very difficult, and I think that's a reasonable conclusion that any of us can draw. But again, we do not know where the dismemberments took place.
The statement of facts is quite lengthy when it comes to the passwords, but I see the second victim. Can you talk about that a little bit? Is there really much detail about his last moments or what you suspect is or happened to him later than any other victim? Can you speak a bit to that? You know, was there a frustration to figuring at least together the last moments, or you know, were there things that didn't enter into the court record?
Again, my answer is the same. The statement of facts is based on evidence and what we can prove in court, what the Crown can establish. And if you guys want a more fulsome agreed statement of facts, then I don't know what the mechanism is to get that. So.
Well, I mean, evidently, okay. You investigated that.
Thank you. That concludes today's news conference.
Hi, this is Police Constable Danielle Botno, also known as LGBT Cop, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Terra on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Welcome back. So that was my spotlight on serial killer Bruce MacArthur, the sentencing news conference from police headquarters. We heard from Police Chief Mark Saunders, Homicide Inspector Hank Exinga, as well as Detective David Dickinson and LGBTQ2S Liaison Officer Constable Danielle Botno. Up next, Hour 2 of Rainbow Country, featuring The Gay Artist Way with recording artist Santino.
Hi, this is Carol Pope on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Welcome back. This is Hour 2 of Rainbow Country, and in this hour, The Gay Artist Way, featuring recording artist, hair and makeup artist, Santino. So my friends, stay tuned for Gay Talk Radio Toronto Style right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Segato, and you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM.
Artist for film and television. He's also a recording artist, and his latest single is a remake of the classic 1983 hit single I O U. He is Santino. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good.
Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
So let's start here today now. Your current single, I O U, originally done by British pop group Freeze.
Yes.
I-O-U.
Yes.
Why did you choose to remake this particular song? Why this song?
You know, I have a lot of music on my library, and I just, every time I heard it, I loved the way it sounded. You know, I always go for the sound of the music, and then I start to listen and focus on the vocals, and that spoke to me. That song spoke to me. I like the fact how, you know, someone, you know, can take some kind of like situation in life and bring it to song, you know, a meaning, something's happening. And I heard the vocals and I said, okay, what are they saying? They're saying that, you know, you treat me a certain way when no one's around. And then when people are around, you're completely different. And I identified with that because that happened to me a lot in high school, a lot. And I never understood it. Until now. And I like the way how someone put it to song.
So would you say that you were bullied in high school? Like, what are you trying to say there?
I wasn't bullied. I think there were people, you know, that liked me. And my self-confidence was so low that I was always aiming to please. But I think a lot of, you know, men, teenagers, guys liked me, and you know, but they couldn't like me that way because obviously back in the 80s it wasn't accepted. So they liked me, and you know, they wanted to spend time with me, and they knew that the only way they would have to be able to spend time with me is to show me some kind of affection. And they did, but it was never in front of anybody. And that's where that kind of feeling of like, you get okay. It connects that way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
but I was never bullied.
Okay.
Yeah, I was pretty.
That's good.
I was pretty much a fashionista. You know, it was funny. It was funny. You know, I was already a hairstylist in grade 10. I was licensed already, so you know, I was doing haircuts for $5. Uh-huh. You know, and they'd say after school, can you cut my hair? Sure, $5, and that was it. You know,
yeah.
Which was a lot of money back then. You know.
So there's also a music video for your version of I Own
You.
Yes,
there is, yes.
So talk to me about this music video. Is there a concept?
There's absolutely a concept.
Okay. And what? How would you describe the concept?
Towards the song, you mean? Yeah. The concept, I wanted to touch so many different levels of the things that people say, well, that is bad. That's bad, or that doesn't look good, or that's not right. In my video, you know, I see, at some points, I'm on the beach with a girl, and I'm playing straight because I can't say that I'm gay. There's another scene where, you know, I'm wearing like a kind of like a shaggy wig because obviously, you know, being bald, oh my God, you know, men have hair. Men should have a full head of hair. That's what's accepted. And what else? There's, you know, wearing a fur jacket, you know. You know, people, there's people who say, oh, you know, not wearing a full jacket. You shouldn't wear a fur jacket. And I'm thinking like, okay. So I want to touch that base because there's some people that say, oh, I don't like that. I don't believe in wearing animal skins or leather or whatever. Yet you have a leather belt on. Yet you have leather shoes on or what have you. You know, which one is it? Do you want this or you don't want this? Mm. Smoking. I was smoking a cigarette in there. You know, ooh, it's bad to smoke. But I did that. So you're in your bedroom. These scenes are taking better, so no one can see it.
So are you playing different characters,
yes,
or are you making more commentary on society?
I think a bit of both, actually, you know. I am playing different characters because really, you know, you got that eccentric, you know.
Because in one scene, you're like flogging yourself or something,
yes,
in a bedroom.
Big one. Yeah, that was the one I forgot. Yes. Well, and I can't believe I forgot it, but there's a scene where I'm wearing a corset, a real serious singer. Mm-hmm. That I've got at Northbound Leather. There's your, what's it called? Northbound Leather.
Plug?
There's your plug, Northbound Leather. Yeah, I got that Northbound Leather, and I had a huge, like a serious rosary that a lot of Catholics would hang above their bed. So that belonged to a family, my family. Anyway, I've inherited it. So I thought, I'm going to whip myself with that crucifix on the back. Mm-hmm. Sort of like I'm carrying that religious on my back, that weight, sort of like what, you know, quote, you know, Jesus did when he carried that cross across, the same idea, you know, I'm carrying all this burden on my back, you know, and come to think about it, even me in the water, I'm drowning. The water, I'm just drowning in all my lies, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. So, so I don't, you have a point, you know, there's so many people who are such hypocrites, I guess.
Yeah.
A lot of hypocritical people these days, you know. They say one thing and do another.
Yeah.
And I don't understand that. Mm-hmm. I was actually talking to my partner about that this morning. It's starting to kind of bother me more than ever.
So did you come up with all these various scenes, that sort of thing? Did you work in collaboration with a team?
I had Frank and his team, which were the producers of the video. We sat down and I already had a feeling of everything I wanted to do. We just had to place it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they would add on a little bit, like there's a part where I have a driver who drives me around. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was his idea, which was a great idea. But every scene I wanted to see how far I could go. Mm-hmm. You know, you have 2 minutes and I mean 80 seconds, I guess. How much can you fit in there? I fit in quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to get as many things as I could. And, you know, you see me with hair and you see me without hair. You see me with a fur jacket, without the fur jacket. Smoking, not smoking, you know. Mm-hmm. And the straight scene was really hard to play. You know, when you look at me, I look straight. But my actions and when I open my mouth, it's a little different. So even though Kiara, which is a phenomenal actress, when she was there with me, mm-hmm. She was actually coaching me as we were doing the scenes because I was like, this is so uncomfortable for me. I was even as we're acting, it was uncomfortable.
Why did you want to play a straight person then?
Because in the lyrics of the song, they talk about, it talks about that, you know, like it all generalizes back to the same thing. You know, why can't I be this way everywhere and I can only be who I am in my four walls at home. Mm-hmm. So I have to be this for society to accept me. Mm-hmm. And it's still happening. You know, People are not letting people go forward or move forward, whether it's in their career, mm-hmm. relationship, mm-hmm. schooling, you know, whatever this is. There's always somebody there. Mm-hmm. This is where I get political. There's always someone there who's going to stop you from doing that, whether their intentions are because they're envious, threatened. They don't want to see people succeed, whether it's something inside them to right. stop you. Mm-hmm. Now I'm steering off a little bit, I think. But, you know, I picked Being Straight because I wanted that big thing there too mm-hmm. to coincide with the rest of the ideas I had, you know, mm-hmm. the points I was making through the video or filming it.
So that's your current single.
Yeah.
But let's go back to 1991.
Okay.
Lust or Love?
Yes. Yes.
So this is your first single.
This is my first single. It was on Sony Music.
So how do you feel hearing this?
You know, I listened to it and I was so young mm-hmm. and I was actually really happy at that point. I was out of high school.
Because we should say, this is on your YouTube channel.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And it's a live performance at Wonderland?
Yes, Wonderland Kingswood. Kingswood Wonderland. Mm. And I was performing and I had my backup dancers. And if you go to YouTube. And you watch the video, you can see everybody's mouths are just like they're in shock. And I didn't really think it was that shocking, but I guess a man or a teenager mm-hmm. at that point, I think it was 19 or 18, on stage wearing chaps.
Yeah, you're wearing leather chaps.
Leather chaps, a leather jacket. Sort of a George Michael thing happening. And, you know, later on the chaps come off, obviously, but I'm wearing jeans. But it was shocking still. No matter what celebrity does it, it's still always going to be shocking.
Now, was it shocking because you were being perceived as gay, you think? Or because you're on stage wearing leather chaps?
Like, I think it confused people because I had that kind of like New Kids on the Block look. Mm-hmm. And I think I just took it to another level because I'm wearing all these gay innuendos, but I have all these two girls groping me. It's too confusing for them. They don't understand. Mm-hmm. Girls shouldn't be groping a man wearing that.
Right. Okay.
You see what I'm saying? They should be groping a man. That's where it comes in the more complex stuff. They should be groping a man, not a man wearing that. Men should be groping that, not women.
How did the song come about?
I wrote this song. I wrote a few songs, about 15, I think. When I was 16 and onwards, I didn't use an instrument. I do play instruments. I played the brass instruments in high school for 5 years. But when I was writing these songs, I do a different way of writing. I don't use an instrument. I use notes. And when I want to hit a note, I just, you know, memorize it, write the notes high, mm-hmm. low. It's a harder way to do it, but if you can do it, it's great because mm-hmm. you don't have to elaborate with people.
Yeah.
So I wrote Lust or Love. There was different versions to it. And then the studio I was working with in Scarborough, they came around and said, okay, you know what? We met somebody in Sony Music and we're going to release a compilation. Do you want to be in it? And I says, absolutely. So we picked Lust or Love. And that was it. I got my single deal, which was great. And it did great. It did really, really well. I performed at the Dance Fest Summer. Was it Dance Fest Summer? What was it called again? 108 Dance Summer Fest. That was it. 108 Dance Summer Fest. And that was great. And I performed my song up there with my dancers. Mm-hmm. They were fantastic. And the song was on the radio. It went to 25 in Montreal on the dance charts. Mm-hmm. It was very ultra, ultra poppy. And it did well. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I didn't know. It was harder in Toronto, you know? Like, it's really hard to find the avenue, the road, the direction, or the help mm-hmm. to get to where you want to go.
Right.
And sometimes you're scared because you're, you know, you're working, you're making money, and then you're spending it. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to be spending on ideas that are not the right ideas. So I was really careful with what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And that was that, you know?
Well said.
Exactly.
On that note, let's take a break.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
Great.
Hi, this is Nikki Ward, and like me, you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM.
So Santino, you are a hair and makeup artist as well as a recording artist.
Yes.
You do hair and makeup for TV and film.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into this originally? How did that come about for you?
You know, I had my salons and they were fantastic and I did that for many, many years and I enjoyed it. I started feeling stagnant. I felt like, you know, claustrophobic, stuck in the same place every single day, which some people like, you know, but it was weathering to me, you know. At that point, I was doing it for so many years. I thought, you know, I need something different, something to spice my career up in film and in hairstyling mm-hmm. and makeup. So I went and looked into the film and TV industry. And so I applied and did a course and I did a test. It was hard doing a test because, like, you know, with my years of experience, my mother, my father, and my sister were hairstylists, you know, I already knew how to do period hair. And so I did the test because, you know, I respect the process. I did the test and I, you know, of course I passed and then became a member. And I started.
You became a member for
a union. For the filming. There's two unions in the, there's NABET, which is in Ontario. And they have IATSE, which is across the globe.
Okay.
So I'm a member of NABET. I'm a permittee of IATSE, and which is good enough for me. You know, what I mean, I can only spread myself so far, right? And so I started doing film and television. They recognized, you know, my craft and how I easily do period. I could do it, and they need that. You know, a lot of hairstyles these days only do contemporary styling,
mm-hmm.
and it's hard to find a stylist that can do both contemporary and period. So,
so how long have you been doing this now?
Hairstyling or film?
Both.
Both. Now, let me think. I went to hairstyling school when I was 15.
Oh, wow.
Just turning 16, mm-hmm. and then I got licensed in about a year and a half. And so I think 37 years now.
Wow.
37 years, yes. Yeah, so it's been a long haul, but it's been great.
Mm-hmm.
And and film and TV has been great also. I've met more, you know, people in the industry and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. It's nice to know, you know, that you
kinda... Do you have any interesting stories working on set in regards to, not necessarily mentioning names,
yeah.
but any situations that sort of jump out at you, whether good or bad, about, you know, working on certain things that you can discreetly share?
You got to give me a direction. let me think.
So you're on set
yeah.
for a project.
Okay.
And, you know, any divas, any tantrums, any TRs going flying?
Oh my God, there's always tantrums and there is, you know, I laugh, like, you know, sometimes I just sit there and I start to shake up, like I'm watching it in front of my face and it's always coworkers and because you have to understand, like, you're waking up at like hours like 2:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kept thinking of Joan. Joan, I know I can do this, Joan. And, you know,
Joan Rivers?
Joan Crawford.
Oh, okay.
And you're waking up these hours because she was a perfectionist. So mm-hmm. she'd probably get up earlier than she should have got her. But, you know, she wanted to be prepared. You know, she had a whole regime of doing things in the morning. Some actresses and actors now will get up, you know, at a certain time. Oh, screw the, you know, the lifting of the face or creams or extra things just to make my skin tighter. She had a regime, and you know, she was a perfectionist, and good for her.
Mm.
So I'm a perfectionist, so I would wake up early, a little earlier, because I want to look good for work. Yeah, I can't walk to work and looking a certain way. Mm. You know what I mean? I like to go to work looking like a professional,
mm-hmm.
And being, you know, up to par with everything. I want people to know that I'm a perfectionist, that I'm a professional. I look good. I'm dressed and ready for the job. I can't just put anything on, you mm-hmm. know? So that takes a little longer. So you get up at 2:30 in the morning. Sometimes you're filming, you know, in areas like Cambridge or Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Hamilton. And you have to go grab a shuttle downtown somewhere, and this van picks you up, and you get in and get there, and you have like, I don't know, 50 to 60 background updos for a period show, and it gets really stressful.
So do you tend to do period shows or
yes.
that sort of thing?
I go out and do contemporary stuff because it's really easy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's definitely easy contemporary for me. I find it very mm-hmm. easy. But period, I love doing it, you okay. know. And we're going from 1890, 1880, 1860. Mm-hmm. Then you went to 1910. I finished I was working on a show last year, and I did 1920. It was taking place in that era. So, you know, it keeps you on your toes.
Let's talk about something that you did, I think, the last few months.
Yeah.
Was you worked with Amanda Bruegel?
Yes, I did.
From Handmaid's Tale.
Yes.
She plays Rita.
That's right.
And you did a shoot with her where you did her hair, and it appeared on what, like three different magazine covers?
Yes, it did. I was doing a couple of days on Kim's Convenience.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was I went in and I was going to be taken care of. You know, not the main cast. She is cast on Kim's Convenience, but there's also day players and mm-hmm. what have you. So she was there, and we were talking, and we got along really well, which was really nice. She's really gorgeous, just beautiful in her skin. It's just a really nice lady. Anyway, we were talking, and then we kind of just clicked. We clicked and stuff, and she says, you know, I'm looking for someone to do my hair. Like a team. I want a regular team of people.
Right.
I'm not going to do her hair all the time. Just, you know, whenever it rises that she wants a certain date, time,
mm-hmm.
town, whatever. You know, she's looking. So I said, you know, I'm totally in. You know, I pulled out my phone, got my digits, and here's my IG account. Mm-hmm. So she looked at it, and she saw the stuff I do, right? And that was it. And then she called me. It didn't happen right away because I met her 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
She called me out of the blue, emailed me out of the blue. And so I did her hair. She called me. She says, are you interested? And I said, it's on a Sunday. She says, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm totally interested. And we got in, and I got there that morning. We were there. I brought everything. I even brought in some wigs too,
because mm-hmm.
you never know.
So how does that work? Walk us through this process. You're going to be doing a shoot with a celebrity.
Yeah.
How do you know what to do with them? Are you given a brief by their agent, by the magazines, by the talent themselves? How does that work?
So this faux shoot I did with her, mm-hmm. She was just doing some print, she wanted to get some pictures done mm-hmm. and what have you. We didn't know where these pictures were going to land,
okay.
which was funny, but cause usually, you know, you're going to do a cover and then you know, it depends. The magazine might have their own stylist
right.
or you bring your own team, but these were just being done.
Mm.
So there wasn't anything there. Like, we talked a little bit about it. Like, maybe we'll do something a little period.
Okay.
You know, maybe we'll do this. That's how, and mm-hmm. I just brought the wigs. We didn't even talk about wigs.
Mm-hmm.
I just brought them.
Mm-hmm.
And we got there. There was the stylist, which is for, you know, wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
They were there and they had the clothes. And I'm really quick. I look at the clothes right away. I don't really deal with the makeup. Like, when I'm hired as a hairstylist, they usually have someone doing the makeup.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want to know about makeup with hair. It's always the clothes. Is it collar? Is it off the off the shoulder?
Right.
What have you? So because sometimes when it's off the shoulder,
mm-hmm.
you sometimes put it up.
Okay.
So I had so many styles, and I brought in this gorgeous, gorgeous lace front wig, blonde, like platinum, and it was long.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost like Cher down to her waist, and we didn't even know we were going to use it. So I started doing some styles, and then I said, let's use the wig.
Okay.
And I put it on, mm-hmm. and she posted actually with me behind her, but it was just hot. It looked unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And they used that wig for one of the covers. Mm-hmm. It was just beautiful. Part in the middle, dead straight. I didn't have to iron it. I put some pomade to it, and it was just shiny and gorgeous. It looked so good on her.
And what magazines did these ended up showing on?
We had Afro Style magazine. Mm-hmm. It was there was pictures on there on the cover. She was the cover of that. And then Chloe magazine and Toronto Fashion magazine. Mm-hmm. And they were all there. I couldn't believe it. So it was my first time getting recognition for print. Mm-hmm. For hair, which is a great achievement. You know, I think when it comes down to, you know, my mom, my dad, and my sister were fantastic hairstylists, mm-hmm. but they never took it to the next level. So I was really happy I took it to the next level.
Yeah.
And to get recognition, you know, and she's a great, great person, which is nice. It's also a bonus, you mm-hmm. know? So I remember, you know, it's funny. I want to mention this because it's really funny, but I was on YouTube, and I like Joan Crawford, you know. I love her. I don't know, you know, everything's always hearsay, you know. You don't know the truth, right? I don't think she was that bad. That's my opinion. I just don't think she was that bad. She's probably strict, but I don't think she was, you know, half the things that were. It's always mommy dearest. I just don't think that. But I'll tell you, I watched an interview with Joan Crawford on some talk show. And she had a beautiful dress on with a wrap, and the wrap matched the dress. And the interviewer said to her, and this was in the 70s, by the way. He said, oh, your hair, like, you know, I love what you're wearing. It looks great. That wrap as well. And I actually respect her for saying this. Well, you know, there's a reason why I'm wearing this wrap around my hair. And she says, what's that? I says, my hairdresser decided not to show up this morning. Like, I'm watching this interview on YouTube, and I couldn't even believe that somebody would think that that was okay, not to show up to do Joan Crawford's hair, even if she was a nightmare. You know what I mean? I just found that so unprofessional, and how for granted you take things. You know, I would give anything to have done her hair, you know? Mm-hmm. And I always wonder, I can't believe a hairdresser. So she says, and at the end of the interview, she says, well, let's just say I'll never have him do my hair again. Mm. So yeah, I always think about that, you know?
Well, on that note, Santino, let's take a break.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
Hi there, I'm Glenn Dixon, and you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on CIUT 895 FM, discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station, specifically for our issues, to talk about people in the LGBTQ community, and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And of course, our artists and the things that we do globally and right here in Toronto, and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So support, tune in. Thank you.
Hey there, it's David Dixon, Canadian fashion designer, and you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM.
So Santino, you've worked with Amanda Bruegel from Handmaid's Tale. So maybe I can put you on the spot to name drop. Like, who else have you worked with?
You know, I've worked with...
Inquiring minds want to know.
Okay, so I worked with Whoopi Goldberg. Mm-hmm. Really nice lady. She's exactly who she is on screen, it's the same. Like, you're not, there's no difference whatsoever.
And in what context did you work with Whoopi Goldberg?
She did, she was doing a feature here called A Day Late, A Dollar Short. Mm-hmm. And I worked, I did a couple of days on that. And I was covering set, and she, you know, was wearing a little vest and dress pants, and she just looked over at me, and she smiled, and I smiled, and then later on when I was coming out, they called, you know, they said, you know, it's lunchtime, so we went, and she was there, and we started talking. It was really quick, you know. She had a bus. That's where she stayed. I don't think she flies. I think she goes from bus, you know. Anyway, we were talking, and I remember looking at her, and, you know, the thing is, I've never been really starstruck, you know. Mm-hmm. It doesn't do to me. So I looked at her and says, I got to tell you something, you know. I said to her, my mom died. I said to her, you know, I always think of that movie Ghost, and, you know, really touched me. And she says, and, you know, and she held my hand and says, I bet you think of her every day, every time you watch this. I do. It was really nice. And she's a nice lady, really nice lady. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I worked with En Vogue, another feature. They were hilarious.
Really?
Oh, they were hilarious. You know, a lot. I didn't know the gay community loved En Vogue. You know, I just liked the song. I never thought it was like the really gay icons type of thing. But I was there doing it, you know, another week on a feature. Mm-hmm. And they were here, I think it was En Vogue Christmas. And I was in the trailer, and I really wanted a picture for them. I don't know why, because, you know, they were so bougie, these girls. And so I'm standing there, and I'm in the middle, and it's the trailer, you know, it's obviously black hair, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm there, and I'm the only white guy, which is funny. But I said, I really like the – no, the makeup artist said, oh, Santino wants a picture with you. You know, they went outside because one of them was in the truck leaving. They went outside to get her to stop the truck, come back, and we took a selfie, all four of us.
Wow.
Yeah, four of us, and that was it. And, so, and then Daniel Kraft, then I think Daniel Radcliffe, he was really a pleasant to work for F Word. Mm-hmm. I did a couple of weeks on that. Daniel Radcliffe, he was really great. But there's quite a few.
When you're doing something like that, do managers, agents, that sort of thing, like step in sometimes before you start work, saying to treat people a certain way or to only call people a certain thing? Does that ever come into play at all?
You know, it does. Like, you can't really stare, you know, and, you know, you can't, like, you have to really learn the difference between TV and reality. And, you know, I was just working on a feature this week and with Felicity Huffman, you know, and you know, you're sitting there and you're saying, oh yeah, okay, so I saw this girl do Transamerica, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't faze me, and that's what you have to do. It can't faze you. Mm-hmm. You can't get too caught up into it. Oh my God, it's Felicity Huffman. She was in this movie, and oh my God, wait till my friends find out. Blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, it didn't do that. I was just like, here's a human being who's an actress, and we're working, you know, and that was it, you know. And so there's a protocol, you know. Now, I can't help it if the celebrities, you know, clock me. They're like, okay, right there he is, and they come over for me, which happens, you know. I can't stop that, you know. I do have a bit of a presence, so they have come up to me and started talking to me. Now, whether other people like it or not, that's too bad, actually, because I can't do anything about it.
Do they tell you not to approach?
Yes, you shouldn't approach people, you know, lead actors and stuff. You just shouldn't. You know what I mean? Like, they're in their zone, you know, and they're working. And it's, yeah, I think it's a bit unprofessional. Now, if they're coming up to me, hey, that's all out the window.
So, Santino, you recently celebrated your 18th anniversary with your partner, Jason?
Yes, I did.
And Jason is joining us now. Hi, Jason.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks.
So, how did you guys meet 18 years ago, apparently?
Do you want me to tell him?
Yeah, but you have to be accurate.
I will.
Jason, why don't you tell the story?
Sure. Okay, so...
I've done enough talking. Go ahead.
So we were both at a charitable event. It used to be an event called the Fur Ball, which was a charitable event for the protection of animals. And I wasn't actually going to go. I'd given tickets by someone at work, so I do kind of like a... office type stuff. I'm in IT now, but I was working for Canada Life not far from here then. And I showed up, and this place is like, was that the, used to call it the Phoenix. It's the Diamond now, I think it's called.
It's the other way around.
It's the other way around. Yeah. Sorry. I haven't been there in years. Actually, since we met, that was the last time we were both there.
That's right.
Anyway, he walks in and he's wearing this, at the time, the Matrix movie. So he had this beautiful long leather jacket on. He had this blue shirt undone to his navel, and he had this goatee at the time, and he was like quite striking. And I'm looking across the room, and he looked right at me, and we like kind of stared at each other. And then I spent the evening running after him, trying to talk to him. And he kept avoiding me. And then finally I cornered him, literally. And he said, "Where's your boyfriend?" And I said, "I don't have a boyfriend." He said, "No, I know you have a boyfriend, because my friend Sonia was running this event. She told me I have a boyfriend." So I said, "Where's Sonia?" So she comes over, and she's, I don't know, I want to say she was like 6 weeks to the win. And she just looks at me. She said, "I don't know who this guy is." So that was, and then that was it. I think I piggybacked you all the way from Sherburn and
to my condo,
to your condo at Charles and Church Street.
And you wanted to come upstairs for a cup of tea, and I said no.
Standard.
Actually, I was being a good girl.
Well, I think you have to say that that's probably why part of the success of our relationship is not based just on sex.
Mm.
And we didn't actually, we weren't physical together until 3 months in.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
And
funny enough, I had a client. When I met Jason, I had my second salon, because I've had three. So I was at my second salon, and I had a client who actually liked Jason. I didn't know it was Jason. And I said to him, "Well, you know, just ask him out." I said, "I'm too scared. I'm too shy." I said, "Well, then just put a letter underneath his door saying, oh, I'd like to take you out." So he did it. And Jason said no. And then after I met Jason, it was funny. It was the same guy.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
A lot of interesting things. Yeah.
So you guys have been together for 18 years?
Yeah, I think that to me it's a testament that all relationships can work. You just have to put the effort in. Like, we had a rough patch, but we got through it. And I'm mostly to blame for that. But he's a wonderful guy, and I'm the most lucky guy in the world, I think, to be with him.
Oh, thanks.
So are you guys married?
No, not yet. But to us, it's not that,
is that important?
To me, it's not. I personally look at marriage as a bit of an anachronism, and you look at, I think some people enter it a little frivolously, and I think that if you look at the rate of divorce, et cetera, mm-hmm. I think that I don't think it's that important to us. I don't know. I've never asked you really how you felt about it. I think the idea has come up a couple times. We decided just not to do it yet. It might happen. I think
it's funny. You know, I have had customers over the years say, "Oh, we had to go. Me and my partner had to get legally married because, you know, because if you're not legally married, then you can't collect their CPP and old age pension."
So it's practical reasons for marriage, yeah. Fiscal reasons.
I hate to out people there, but it's the truth, right? So I don't know. I don't. I think that marriage, well, it's nice.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think it's, you know, really that important.
Right.
I think this is where the question of why it's important for people to understand why we fought so hard, though, for the right to get married. And it was a call from a progressive conservative politician. I can't remember his name. He was running in the Beaches area. And I said, I would never vote conservative. I said, because of your stance on same-sex marriage. And he said, "I don't understand. You guys have common law." And I said, "You obviously don't understand the laws of this country, because common law relationships don't actually get the same benefits and rights as married couples." So, for example, what Santino was alluding to was the idea of survivor benefits after a partner dies. Lots of married couples, for example, are entitled to, I think it's 75% of the benefit that the partner was receiving. If you only have common law status, you're not entitled to that. There's also other things around sort of estate law and things like that that are important. For example, if one of us dies, if we're not married, so there'd be practical reasons where we might decide to get married later, right? And it's just because until the laws change and they recognize different forms of relationship, the most important one from many perspectives, at least from a legal perspective and a fiscal perspective, is you need to be married.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's a good reason to fight for something like that.
Right.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah. So Santino, mm-hmm. When did you know that you were gay?
I've always known I was gay, and I was always openly gay.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate. I always tell people that I'm very fortunate. Very, very openly gay since I remember. I mean, I remember days in like way back until like 19, well, grade two, where a teacher would say, why aren't you playing with the boys? And says, you know, because I like to play with the girls. And it says, oh, you know, who do you like? Oh, I like John, or I like, you know, I like boys. I don't like girls. Mm-hmm. I was very open. And they said, no, you should like girls. I said, no, I don't. I'm going to like boys. Mm-hmm. Very openly gay. And coming from a Sicilian family was really interesting. You know, my dad couldn't do anything about it, which was really funny. You know, a real tough, tough, like, Sicilian guy, mm-hmm. and couldn't do anything about it. And knew that I would do what I wanted. I always did, you know. Never had to lie to say I'm this, you know. I never had to do that. Mm-hmm. Only once I did it, you know. Just to, like, my dad did get at one point when I was 17, I think people were starting to bother him, you know, his brothers or sisters or whoever. And they were actually starting to question, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. You know, he clearly likes guys, what are you going to do? And then my dad started really putting the pressure on me. So I said, you know what? I'll wait till I move out. So I'll just keep him quiet. So I started dating a girl. So I was juggling that. And it wasn't because, you know, all my friends knew, all my girlfriends knew. We were just doing this because, and I was honest. Yeah, I'm doing it because of this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my mother knew I wasn't happy. But no, I was always openly gay. You never really got too bothered either, mm-hmm. you know, because I always had a look about me, you know, and always had, my friends were always the tough guys, you know, which was interesting too. And yeah, it was really well. Yeah. And so ever since, I never had to physically say, I want everybody to know. I didn't have a big party.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I didn't have to have a big party.
Jason, what about yourself? When did you realize that you were gay?
I knew I was different. I didn't accept that I was gay until I was, say, I remember I was 17 years old, and there was a program on City TV about coming out. And it was one of those things I was watching, and I kept going away and turning it off and turning it on, watching, going to another channel. But I kept identifying with what people were saying in there, and I knew that I had these feelings about this other men, and finally there was this one kid who was about my age, and he said that the hardest thing for him to do is look in the mirror and say that he was gay. And I actually did that effort, and it was hard, but it was about 17 years of age that I accepted the fact that I'm gay. Mm-hmm. And I didn't tell anybody about it or do anything about it until I was 22, and that's when I came out at the age of 22. Yeah. So as a result of a parking ticket, of all things. But anyway.
Wow.
Yeah.
A parking ticket makes you come out.
It was an interesting story. Yeah. So
can you share it?
I'll do the abridged version.
Sure.
Okay. So I was going out with friends. So I borrowed my mother's car because I didn't have my own. I was in university, actually U of T. This is my alma mater, actually. And I parked on a street off of Church Street. I think it was Charles. And I didn't see the sign that said you need a permit after a certain time. So we're out doing whatever, and we come back, get into the car, and there's a parking ticket. So that night, the next day I get home, and I said to my mom, I said, I got a parking ticket with your car, but I'm going to pay it. And she kept insisting, no, give it to me, I'll pay it. And I said, but it's my ticket. And she kept saying, no, no, no. And then, so I said, I finally relented, and I gave her the ticket, and she looked right at the location, and she said, what are you doing down here? And I didn't know at the time that she had worked at there's a cafe there at the corner of Charles and Church now called the Croissanterie, but there used to be a bank there, and she worked as a teller at that branch. And even then, this would have been the early 70s. Even then, there was a large gay population in what is now the Church Wellesley neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I knew she thought something was up. So she did something strange. She went for a walk that night after dinner, and I thought she's thinking about this. So I'm waiting for her at home, and I'm waiting. I'm like, how am I going to – I got to come clean. I got to tell her, right? And we had this conversation, and she said, what's wrong? I said, I want to tell you something. I don't know how to do it. And she said, well, if I had to guess, I said, well, what would you guess? She said, I think you prefer the company of men. I said, I do. Right? And then she said, well, I was blessed because my family was wonderful. Like, I really was. They were wonderful. I didn't have any – even my own father, who I didn't expect, wrote me a beautiful letter to sort of say that he loved me no matter what.
Nice.
Well, my mother had said something funny. She said, I don't care what you do as long as you don't start wearing my clothes. I said, first of all, that's not my thing. And I said, second of all, I've got much better taste than you. So.
Oh
study.
Well said. Well said, Jason. So, Santino, yeah. How can people find out all about you and all that sort of good stuff?
Well, I have a Instagram account. So, it's Santino underscore hairstyles underscore makeup, all lowercase. And then I also have, Twitter. It's like MS Calora or Michael Santino for Twitter. And I do Snapchat. And I also do my iTunes will be coming out. That's probably going to be under Santino as mm-hmm. well. But I have my YouTube, which is under Santino. Mm-hmm. And if you can't find it, just type in IOU and you'll see right there.
Santino IOU.
IOU. Yeah. And my Instagram is, it's actually doing really well. It's doubled in views and it's doing really, really well, which I'm really happy. And that's, again, Santino underscore hairstyles underscore makeup. And you'll have all pictures now, more personal pictures. You see a lot more of my work, but now I'm trying to add more of my music there too.
Well said.
Yeah.
Well said.
Yeah.
Santino, Jason, thank you both. Thank you both for coming in and thanks for your time.
Well, thank you for having us. Yes. I really appreciate it. And I can't wait till the next interview.
It's wonderful, Mark. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Really appreciate it.
When we're alone, I really feel in love. When we're out with friends, I see a change. You treat me bad, I feel like second best. I want your love, give me your love. That's how I feel, and I want it to be real. I want your love.
Recording artist Santino, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on CIUT 89.5 FM.
That was my spotlight on the Gay Artist Way, featuring recording artist, hair and makeup artist, Santino. And like he was saying, to find out about all things Santino,
just check him out on socials. Just type in Santino. Make it easy for yourself. It's been a jam-packed 2 hours of Rainbow Country. Hour one, serial killer Bruce MacArthur, the sentencing news conference from police headquarters. Hour two, the gay artist way with recording artist Santino. Don't forget, get social, get interactive on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook at Mark Tara Music. The podcast for Rainbow Country is on iTunes, Podomatic.com, Google Play Music, Stitcher Radio, and on Spotify. And don't forget, subscribe to the podcast, because that way you'll keep up to date with the most recent episodes of Rainbow Country. And of course, everything is hooked up at my website, including the full 2 hour episodes that you can find under the archives, marktara.com. That's my website. And then just look for the banner that says archives. And you'll find 3 seasons, 3 years of episodes. And this is episode 138. So there you go. Next week, a record release listening event, party, whatever you want to call it, with local recording artist Tessa. I hope you'll tune in for that. They'll be live in studio with me. Tessa and producer Pete will both be live, and we'll be listening to her new record along with you. Hopefully, you will join us. Finally, I want to take this time to thank you for taking your time to be with me. Remember, we live in days of making dreams come true. So believe in yourself, and the world will believe in you.
This is City Councilor Kristen Wong-Tam, and you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM.